Welcome to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, bringing you a program dedicated to the life of the mind. In this program, we talk to Professor William Compston, geochronologist. As a young scientist, Bill used new techniques employing radioactive isotopes to determine the ages of rocks. He became a world authority, and he and his lab were among a handful chosen by NASA to determine the age of the moon rocks brought back by Neil Armstrong in Apollo 11 and in the subsequent lunar missions. This led to the building of a new instrument for age determination, the Sensitive High Resolution Iron Microprobe, affectionately known as SHRIMP. The SHRIMP was used to find the world's oldest mineral in Western Australia and the oldest whole rock in the world in Canada, with ages in excess of 4 billion years. This interview was kindly recorded for me by the National Library of Australia in their Oral History Studio in Canberra. Copyright in this interview remains with the National Library. Please see more details on the website about that. Bill and I began by discussing how he first became a geologist.
Well, I was born in West Australia, and my father was the local butcher. He had previously been a horse trainer. I was the only child of the marriage of my father and my mother, but my father was my mother's second husband, and she had five children previously. My mother was running the local grocery store that's near my father's shop, and they clearly met in the course of grocery transactions and butchery transactions. In effect, I was the youngest child, almost an only child in one sense. The others were significantly older than me.
Did you play with them?
Oh, I learned to play football with my next youngest brother, locally, you know. I went up to the local field and we played football, the great passion of my life at one stage. I was very fond indeed of my sister, my one sister, who's now dead like almost everyone else. She, you know, there was a fairly wide gap in age between us, so she would tend to use her maternal instincts on me and look after me and take me round. Well, I had a happy childhood, I think, except for my father's early death. Mm. Well, books in the house, I sort of read all of them that there were, and there weren't that many. But one thing that I do recall being, I was overawed by a birthday present from my parents of the Arthur Mees Children's Encyclopedia, which has got 8 or 10 volumes. But I read these from cover to cover and enjoyed them a lot and learned a lot. I mean, not everything you read when young, you're ready to read. So I was able to get back to them. And that book, I thought, was very good for inspiring a wide interest in many subjects. The other factor is my eldest brother was a science graduate. He also did 3 years of geology, which meant he told me about geology. He would take me on walks. He was also keen on keeping fit. He would go running, and I wouldn't go on the long runs, but I would walk, and he would come back and pick me up. This went on for some years, not just when I was a toddler. The fact that he was a geologist meant that he would tell me things that I'm sure would have influenced my later choice of being interested in geology.
I believe you had an early start with music as well.
Well, I can expand that a little. I was taught music in primary school by the nuns. I went to a convent primary school. My mother was Roman Catholic and my father a Protestant, but the rules of the game is that you have to agree to raise your child as a Roman Catholic, and that's what was done. I wasn't all that keen on the early music studies, which was piano, and it reflected my parents' love of music, and perhaps they hoped I'd be the the star of a party, which I never am. But I went there and then gave up because I wasn't doing my practice properly and I wasn't turned on by what I was learning. But then later on, I had a private teacher, a professional person who had herself done very well as a pianist. The course was set to do music then as a it developed as a higher school certificate subject.
So you kept it up?
Yeah, I did. Well, I went back to it, and it was this second bout with the piano that I particularly enjoyed and learned from. I enjoyed the classics teacher. I mean, it was the term classics wasn't used. It was English. But it was English literature, and that man was very good, very enjoyable. In contrast to that, the science teachers, in retrospect, I realised they were not very good at all. These were Christian brothers. They just didn't know their science. It was as simple as that. And they certainly weren't able to communicate it if they did know it.
I believe you had an early interest in painting at this stage as well.
Well, I was good at sketching, but I never reached the point where I would view painting or sketching as a sort of hobby that some people have. I let that one go. University, well, I just have to say that my eldest brother, the one who took me for walks, while I was in Melbourne, he also took me around the various geological monuments around the city and its nearby environment. And that was interesting for me to do.
Royal Park?
Yes, we went to Royal Park, but we went to these beach areas where you'd see the fossil echinoids in the fairly young sediments.
Van Morrison places.
Yes,
like that,
that's
I think,
right. Yeah. That influenced me. It was always assumed I'd go to the university because I was always good in the class and the classwork. I did end up going to the university and doing science, and with one of the units being geology. The third year being half the standard geological unit, I did the hard rocks rather than the soft rock part of geology. But this was very much my brother's initial influence.
Now, I believe music was, again, a feature of your life, at least as a listener. But you were still playing the piano, were you?
Oh, yes, sure. I played the piano for enjoyment then. Yes, it was early LPs. The music that I encountered at the university was all what you could listen to, either in the form of concert, but mainly in the form of lunchtime enterprises where we borrowed LPs from the university library and played them.
Well, I'm dying to ask you which composers you
are
favoured.
Oh, well, we were at the heroic age, you know, and the books I read presented the various classical composers as godlike almost. And so, I mean, I liked Beethoven, the string quartets of Beethoven, and trios that I hadn't really heard before.
How about Bach?
Yes, well, what you learn on the piano as part of preparing for any exam is that you've got to have Bach, preludes and fugues, and that's certainly what I still play. They were great. They had this appeal that is, I think, peculiar to Bach. They're just plain good.
Let's move on from your graduation. You had physics and geology majors.
Yeah, I did mathematics as well.
Anyway, you went on to a job at the Bureau of Mineral Resources.
Yes.
Research was really an interest that
was starting to press
on your mind.
Strange mental concept that gets into people that you'd want to do research. Well, the question is really asked, research in what? I think it must be an expression of the wish to learn new things. The real question is you should formulate what you want to work on. I asked to do research in the study of radioactivity. I mean, I was involved in the Bureau of Mineral Resources. I was located in Melbourne. I wouldn't have called it researching as much as radioactivity exploration in the field, which is what I did in the first year. The second year, I think we were involved in radiometric mapping, airborne mapping. I complicated my life with the Bureau of Mineral Resources by wanted to get married. I was led to believe that it would be possible to travel to Rum Jungle in the first instance, and then on the return to Melbourne to travel via Perth, where I could get married and go on. But in fact, they said no. They, you know, when it came to the point, they wanted me to stay in Rum Jungle for longer and to travel directly back to Melbourne.
And your wife was a physicist too, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. She, well, that's where I met her, in connection with first year physics and so on, and geology. She did geology. We met, you know, on the way to lectures. I was a shy person. I would always manage to keep a few steps ahead of her rather than fall behind and chat, but I learned to do that later.
It seemed to me, researching your background, that the dating emerged fairly early as a central interest.
Well, the dating certainly came because dating is based on radioactivity. I went back to University of West Australia because I could get a scholarship. The subject initially and remained on what's called stable isotope geochemistry. This means the measuring the relative abundance of the oxygen isotopes, in my case, in fossils. The reason that this was being undertaken was that it reflected the possibility of measuring the temperature of the ancient oceans. And the interest in turn in West Australia was generated by the visit of Mark Oliphant. Well, he was a conduit to the University of West Australia Physics Department people, who decided that they would build a mass spectrometer themselves and start this work. But they felt the need for a geologist to produce some wisdom in the way of selection of samples. And that's where I came in. But the idea was that, I mean, the oxygen isotope study started with Harold Urey. He, in turn, was involved in the Manhattan Project for isotope fractionation of all sorts, for isotope concentrations. And that's, he worked at that from the chemical point of view, the chemist point of view. He was a physical chemist. What we worked on, what we used, was certainly the result of what had been developed during the Manhattan Project. I mean, that was a colossal step forward in scientific capabilities, even though, you know, the goal of an atom bomb might not be philosophically approved. What we also were influenced by were other developments of the Manhattan Project, which is how you measure very small amounts of trace elements. And, I mean, that included uranium and lead and rubidium and strontium. They developed what's called the isotope dilution method of analysis. What you do is to add a known amount of an enriched isotope to the sample in which you want to determine, say, the uranium concentration. From the ratio of what you've got in that solution of this enriched isotope to what you measure, then you can work out how much of the uranium is in the sample. And that method is still used. I used it later for the rubidium and strontium method. It's one of the huge developments from the Manhattan Project.
Somewhere in this period you went to Caltech on a Fulbright scholarship.
Yeah, well, that was after the PhD. Didn't quite finish my PhD. There was a Fulbright travelling scholarship on offer that had to be taken up in that year. So I had the choice of going that year, if they'd let me, without having completed the thesis, or possibly getting it finished before in that year, but I felt that was impossible. So I had the agony of working at Caltech on my thesis at night, semi-surreptitiously, to get the thing finished.
Was your wife over there with you?
Yes, that's right. Oh, and we had a child too, and another one on the way. We did all these wrong things.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing time for you, I'm sure.
Well, stressful.
Anyway, so you worked through that fellowship, and I think that was where the O2 isotope work was done, was it?
We got carbon isotope work was done in Perth, and two papers came out of that, which was good for these, you know, the new department, because they, or the new group, it hadn't really got any serious publications. That paper is still referred to, because what we concluded is that there was a significant change in ocean carbon 13 composition with time. Like all sort of interpretations, you'd want to document it more, and it wasn't as well documented as I would have liked, but we were able to say that one interpretation of these results is that the ocean and atmosphere had both been changing in isotopic composition with time, and this is a period in the Mesozoic. The stratigraphic positions were fairly well defined. You know, that's the contrast between those very earliest studies of isotopes where, you know, you get a sample of from here from some person, another sample from over there from a different person, and there's no real integration between them. It's just seeing what can be done. But this was more or less purpose-directed isotope analyses, and it paid off, although it was first poo-pooed by the Caltech group who'd made a big investment in believing that the composition of the oceans was constant with time. They have now been forced, they don't ever recant that, it has been shown since by many people now that there are real changes in ocean composition with time. And these people, to their credit, they did refer to this original mention that we made there.
Do I understand that these changes were biogenic?
Well, we didn't know the mechanism. I don't know whether we use that term, biogenic. Yes, I mean, you would get a change if you had a very large fixation of carbon in a biogenic sink. That would subtract the light isotope selectively from the ocean atmosphere system, and it would make it heavier.
There was sort of a phase when you came back to Australia where you were teaching, you were lecturing.
I felt that the effort that I had to put into preparing lectures was effort I'd sooner put into working on carbon isotopes, or at the time in question it was working on the radioactive dating of rocks.
Kieran Harvey. You're listening to The Study, and we're talking to Professor Bill Constant, geochronologist. Bill went on to explain how he came to do age determination on rocks from the moon.
After I moved to Canberra to the ANU, we had a visit from Paul Gast, who was at Columbia University, the Lamont Geological Observatory. He had done previous studies of seawater, the strontium 87 change in seawater. He was leader of a isotope geochemistry group in Columbia, an influential person. A visit was organized, I think, by the head of our department, Professor Jager. This paved the way for my visit later to Columbia University on sabbatical leave, and just at that time the geochemists were being consulted by NASA in the United States. What would you do with a lunar rock if the astronauts could bring them back? And of course the geochemists' answer is they would analyze every element and trace element in that rock for getting the geochemical fingerprint of the rock as well as measuring the age. I got into that climate of discussion, and my work on dating using the rubidium strontium method was in their mind. I become noted for that. I was chosen after applying to be one of the recipients of the returned lunar samples. We got them from Apollo 11 and 12 and 14 and 15 and 17. The big problem with using the rubidium method for dating is that you had to get enough rubidium and sufficiently small amount of common strontium in the sample you're going to analyze. The moon is filled up with basalt. That's mainly what they brought back. They also brought back another mineral, which is the from the oldest part of the moon, the so-called highlands, which is mainly anorthosite, which is essentially feldspar-rich rocks, which don't have much rubidium, very little of anything. The basalts are not favourable for Rubidium strontium dating unless they're very old. And of course, they are very old. They were very old on the moon, as it happened. We found the rubidium and was concentrated in parts of the crystallised basalt that's called the mesostasis, which has got all the elements that don't fit easily into the main basalt minerals, like there's pyroxene, there's olivine and plagioclase in basalt. None of those admit much alkalies, and that means that they crystallize in sometimes in glass. Strange minerals, rare element-rich minerals that form in the last part of the rock that crystallizes, that freezes. A mineral that we can cleanly extract from the basalt is ilmenite, and many of the ilmenites had a thin film of this glass, this devitrified glass containing the alkalies around it, so that a concentrate of ilmenite would give us a concentrate of the alkalies. And that's what we did on the lunar samples. Of course, the work was done by a team of people. I was the mass spectrometry expert.
There was a bit of tension about
whether we got the right answers, yes. Yeah. Well, in those days, it wasn't the standard practice to pick up the phone and ring overseas. You couldn't even ring another city in Australia without getting someone's approval. We were not able to discover who had got what answers in the United States. So you had to write letters. Basically, it became a rival activity between different laboratories, and they wouldn't tell anyone what they were getting. And so we went to this lunar science meeting in Houston, not knowing whether we'd got the right answer or not. And, of course, everyone else, I guess, was in that boat, although some of them who were buddies no doubt would have confided, taken heart in perhaps getting the right answer, the same answer. So we went cold, though. We didn't know what the answers were, and we had to stand up, and I had to stand up and say, well, this is what we've got, this is what we believe.
I gather your answers came pretty well smack on what big American labs got.
That's right, yeah.
And what age was that?
We got 3.8 billion years.
There's this whole thing about physicists and geologists, for that matter, and the workshop and the hands-on side of it all. I think that's an interesting thing, and I'm wondering how that was for you.
Well, Peter Jeffrey was a very good supervisor, although, you know, as a somewhat arrogant young student, graduate student, you perhaps tend not to realise this at the time, but I realised it subsequently. And he was very helpful to me in many ways. He was an instrumentalist, but he disapproved of spending too much time building instruments or improving gadgets. And he felt that I had spent too much time during my PhD, for example, trying to make the mass spectrometer better.
You like fiddling with the gear, though.
Well, I'm not all that good at it. I mean, initially, when I went to the university, I mean, one of the things to get oriented in your to doing honours in physics, practical work, he gave me a power supply and said, it won't work, fix it. This is a vacuum tube power supply, you know. And I knew very little about it. I drove him mad by clicking this control and that control. You really had to pull things apart and check whether the potentials applied to this particular part were correct or not. But I learned that. I learned the beginnings of practical control of equipment. But to move on to other developments, I was going to mention that it was during the lunar sample analysis program that two things happened. First of all, I first saw a small iron microprobe that was housed at NASA that did a very poor job at analyzing the trace element data that we wanted to have. The other thing that happened is that we were getting fed up with the effort involved with the chemistry, the clean chemistry. You had to maintain a clean air environment, which is difficult. You had to have very clean reagents. They had always to be monitored. And then the task of getting the answer, this involved doing clean chemistry, as I mentioned, but it also involved getting the mass spectrometer to ionize the sample properly. This was a troublesome, erratic, unpredictable process. You could spend a week extracting a sample and find that it wouldn't run. or you messed it up on the, at the very last stage on the mass spectrometer filament. This was hard work. This was one of the reasons why we thought of other ways of doing it, and that, like the iron microprobe. And it, so the lunar program really stimulated me to think about mass analysis by this what's called secondary ionization mass spectrometry. Well, I'd had a PhD student who'd built the mass spectrometer at the ANU that we used for the lunar analyses. And this was a fancy mass spectrometer, not big, but it was designed for the first time in a way that makes the maximum transmission of the usable ions from the thermal filament. Ions, when they evaporate, will initially go in all directions. You want to get as many of these stuffed through the beam defining slit and onto the collector slit in the mass analyzer as possible. Well, there's a way of doing it, a way of calculating what that maximum may be and what are the best ways of doing it, called beam transport theory. And that's a physics-based technique, mathematical technique, and Steve Clement was good at it. It was used for the machine that he developed, and he used it again.
Perhaps I could ask here, yeah, like how important mathematics is, and do you actually do a lot of it yourself?
We do. Clement went through all the mathematics of the beam transport transformations. He did it, but I helped him check various things because some of them are very, very long matrices. But that was essential, that sort of mathematics.
Computers would have been coming in at this stage.
Yes.
Were you using them extensively?
We used computer programs that had been developed for beam transport theory by the nuclear physicists, but we had to write our own program for our particular case. Clement got his program written, and it was done at a big computer in Melbourne, big for those days. What we decided for the iron microprobe was a Japanese design, also based on beam transport theory. We looked at it after Steve had been working on the problem for 6 months or so, decided that there could be no better way of doing it. And the problem was not so much the theory, we felt at this point, but the engineering.
I think you had some skeptics to battle.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Well, we first of all had to convince ourselves and then our director and the committee he took advice from that it had to be a big instrument. All the mass spectrometer companies, they said, oh, I'll build iron microprobes, but you don't need it that big to have high resolution. See, the bigger things are, the more they cost. The more they cost in way of materials as well. I mean, the size of the magnet goes up the square as the turning radius or something like this, so it's a serious business having a big magnet. We had to contend with criticisms from people who thought we were spending too much money, criticisms from overseas people who didn't want to build their own large iron microprobe and kept saying that it would never work what we were doing. They told our new director, not the one who'd approved of the project, but they told our new director when the machine was nearly ready to run that it would never work, it would never do the job. That's bad propaganda. And the new director was Ted Ringwood, who was a very forceful character, and it upset him to hear this. And he in turn came and interrogated us very closely as to was it going to work or wasn't it. Put us on edge, of course. However, it did work.
And I gather you were sort of a victim of your own success for a while. People were queued up to use it.
Well, that is still a problem, yes. Yeah. There's never enough time to take it out of action to try out new approaches. Yeah.
Tell us something about zircons. I still have my copy of Dana's Mineralogy at home.
Yeah, I do too.
Well, he says it's one of the first minerals to crystallize in a magma, and then it's sort of something that lasts forever, just about.
Yeah.
Better than a diamond, isn't it?
We hoped it would be. The zircons came because we realized they were physically robust, at least when they're not radiation damaged. They could be tumbled in the stream, and in fact, tumbling in the stream cleans them up. Western Australia has been always recognized as being the oldest part of the Australian continent. The question is, how can you know whether you've found the oldest rock in a given terrain? The rocks at Mount Narrier, for example, and at Jack Hills are both part of a terrain that contains ancient sedimentary rocks, At the time, I had a graduate student, a New Zealander called Derek Froude. It was his project to go to West Australia and look at the oldest sediments he could find in Archean terrains. So he came back with a whole lot of samples, but the Mount Narrier one, I think they might have done half a dozen grains, one after the other, when the next one was, in fact, over 4 billion years. This answer is not immediately given by the instrument. With a practiced eye, you can look at the chart recorder that we had at the time, and you could see that the lead 207 was unusually high. That's a sign of very old age. I think Derek initially didn't really believe what he was getting. He thought he'd done something wrong. He didn't tell us immediately. He got someone else to carry on, and independently this other person found other old grains. Those were the first old zircons that we knew about. And their ages ranged up to 4.2 million years. This is the huge beauty of iron microprobe, of zircons. You can, and other minerals, which are now being studied in detail, you can get the growth history of a single grain. The oldest rock as an entity is about 3.96 or 99 or something. Yes, that's the Acaster gneiss in Canada.
Yeah.
But we still haven't found an intact 4-billion-year-old rock in Australia. And we've been looking for it for several years as part of a project called the First Billion Years. Excellent. There are lunar rocks up to lunar zircons that we've also worked on now. They are certainly between 4.35 and 4.40.
How is the understanding of the evolution of the Earth, its crust and so forth, the Moon, ancient supercontinents, how's that changed over your life?
As you know, first continental drift, the hypothesis, was greeted with scepticism. For me, it got put on the map by Warren Carey, professor of geology from Tasmania. In about 1964 or 5, another angle that's really connected with continental drift is the plate tectonics model of the Earth, where you get a rising hot plumes, if you like, along the under the ocean, mid-ocean road ridges, and they generate the basalts, and space is made by the severed oceanic crust moving sideways, and at the edges of continents there's subduction of this crust going on. Well, I started from Carey, who was an impressive lecturer, of course, a great actor, as he lectures. Everything is superlative. But that he had a good story. It was unfortunate that it was accompanied by this need, he felt, of having the expanding Earth, because the physicists couldn't see any way that would be viable. But continental drift moved on, nevertheless, because of the plate tectonic mechanism. Well, that would have been, I think, pretty well accepted by the middle 1960s.
You're in the study. I'm Craig Robertson, and I'm with Professor Bill Constant. We concluded our conversation discussing some more general questions about the life of the scientist.
Yeah, life of the scientist. Looking at your publications list, there may be a couple of hundred papers you've published in your lifetime. You're dealing with a worldwide peer group where you've got to defend your research. I'm just wondering if you can reflect at all on the nature of science in that way, that internationalism, travel to America more than once.
Yeah, you have to travel. That's the first thing that I've learned. People now don't believe anything unless you're standing up there forcefully arguing it. Or making the case from this or that example of the process. Unfortunately, people don't read the literature as well or as closely as they should, and sometimes a paper can be obscure and they may not get the point. That's why the United States, for example, is filled up with these conferences, and the Lunar Science Project let us at least go to these conferences once a year. And other conferences, but there's been a change from the use of travel only by heads of departments as it was when I was first at universities, to pretty well anyone who has got something good to say can get funded to go, be given enough money to be encouraged to pay the rest of the cost themselves. So that's one big change.
There have been a lot of changes in research institutions over the last couple of decades, in particular way things work and the managerialism and so forth. Mm-hmm. Do you care to reflect on that? Or?
Oh, well, I certainly have got opinions on this. I lived under the initial regime that was started for the ANU. It was plainly an elitist organisation, and the term elitist had no shame. It was something to be proud of rather than something to be ashamed of, as it is now.
I always think here of Jack Douglas, whom I interviewed before he died, another geologist, and he said of that period it was the days when the scientists ruled the roost.
Now bureaucrats rule the roost. We got funding directly at ANU from a block grant. The directors then had to meet amongst themselves and decide what their research school needed. There was compromise always in settling which school got what. Then the director had his pot of money, and then you had to go and persuade him that this, that and the other is worth doing. And then travel to meetings was also more and more frequent and approved by the school. What happens now, and this is how I lived, this is how the Iron Microprobe was funded. We never had to write a research proposal that would be sent to some external committee who may well be antagonistic towards the ANU because it was elitist, or had been, and was thought to be selfish. You know, projects that wouldn't get funded because of, I felt, antagonism in the committees. There's not supposed to be any, but I can't help feeling that there must be some. So I've never had to, I've had to write proposals for funding from within the ANU, and that's worked out. But I've never had to write, as current staff have to do now, proposals to be sent off to this, that, or the other committee. It's a question of trust. It would be natural for me to feel that the old method of doing it is correct, and I've been a beneficiary. I suppose I'd be a beneficiary in a different regime. I would hope to be, but I've never had to try it.
I'm interested in the way philosophy and physics have had this interplay through the 20th century. It really got a big sort of kick along with Einstein and then the quantum revolution and so forth. In later years, more recently, we've had people like Paul Davies reflecting on whether life's endemic in the universe. Do you think much about those sort of issues?
Well, I think that they are intractable problems. That's the problem. And I much prefer myself to work on things that have got a definite goal that is realisable, evading a definite answer, in other words. But of course I'm interested.
Well, the really interesting one here is this: the sheer age of the Earth.
Yeah.
It's people have used these terms like the abyss of time, deep time, so a more recent coinage. And I think it's been comparable, say, to the Copernican revolution in space. And without this notion of what we might call deep time, you need that to sustain Darwin and evolution. Mm-hmm. Darwin and Lowell were close friends, colleagues. It's a very important, one of the most important things science has ever achieved, I think, showing the sheer age of the Earth. Mm-hmm. It is sort of mind-boggling in its way. And, of course, you've made a major contribution in mapping the length of this time and putting scientific rigour into it. I think it's important in its implications for Western culture at least, and I'm also interested in how this knowledge gets out to the public and is lodges in the public mind, because as you know, there's a lot of resurgent creationism and this sort of thing these days, which impacts on educational policy and so forth, and it's very important, I think, to have a rigorous scientific establishment of the fact that the Earth's at least 4 billion years old, and there's been plenty of time for Darwin's evolution to take place and so forth. Do you have any particular thoughts on that? Well, I'm wondering, with your own background, your upbringing in the church school too,
I didn't feel the need to have a literal interpretation of the Bible. You know, I can't remember the particular. Someone wants a year and date for the event, the beginning of the earth. Well, I thought you have to have these things to be treated very understood very broadly, and it's fairly obvious that the writers of the Old Testament themselves wouldn't have known about the age of the earth at all. They would think the earth was much younger, because of this inability of the human mind to think of a very long time. I've never had any difficulty with the age of the earth being as old as it is, and it's the details of the beginning of the earth that is currently very interesting. But the other interesting thing is certainly how you can get what seems to be sudden appearances of whole new phylums of organisms. And that some of them seem, from the right, the first examples of it, seem to be very well developed. How did they reach that stage of great organization in terms of their eyes and other living attributes? It's, you know, I think the analogy that I heard once, it's like someone conceiving of and building a Boeing 707 with all its intricacies, finding that. How does the first Boeing ever develop? And this is the problem with fossils.
The business of the interplay between theory and experiment and observation, and how they seem to rely on each other to sort of leapfrog each other in a way to push scientific knowledge forward. Did you have any sort of conscious approach to all that?
We have very different ideas as to what you have to do to establish the viability of theory. I mean, in our field, you simply have to have the observation replicated, both from the experimental data. There have to be enough replicate observations so that all are the same to within experimental accuracy. Then you can believe you've got a result. Now, theories that interpret the observations, some observations, many of them, you can have several theories that fit the data, and this is the so-called multiple hypothesis approach to handling data. You live with them, you go with several competing hypotheses, and hope that you can hit on the observations, the diagnostic ones that distinguish separate one from the other.
I was interested whether it would be valid to say that your career had seen the establishment and development of geophysics. I mean, we're being clear exactly when geophysics kind of hived off from geology as such.
There's been a rivalry between geology and geophysics ever since I've entered the discipline. But I think it's a foolish rivalry. It shouldn't be sustained. It probably isn't in the best scientists within either field, but a lot of people
do. It's institutionalised, though, isn't it?
Yeah. I think our particular work is bringing geology closer to physics, but the people who apply our data, who've got the ages of this or that rock, they don't really want to know too much about how the answers are obtained. They just want a number, and they'll go away and use it. But not everyone is like that. There are others who do try to get to the bottom of how the whole system works, and start as geologists, become very, very good at managing the equipment.
Just like looking back over your life, how do you think science is faring now as a large scale social activity? Is it better now, or worse, or just different? I mean, it had a tremendous vitality in certain periods in the 20th century, as we've mentioned, following the Second World War, the Manhattan Project, and then there was, you know, that whole thing with radio and radar and radio physics, etc., a number of those sorts of things, and huge changes in chemistry and so on. Can you see that sort of as an ongoing thing now, or are we
Well, it will be ongoing. I mean, everything you've described have enriched the understanding of geology and science in general, but there are still aspects of material science that are coming up, like the nanotechnologies, and there are also fashions, I think, in what people want to do as scientists. But I think they all have enriched the world. The question is whether they enrich mankind, the way of life. Not everyone wants to strive to learn new things.
Curiosity doesn't come all that naturally. No. It needs encouragement.
Well, I mean, there are. I find that curiosity varies a lot between individuals. My wife, for example, is more curious about things than I am. She's on the ball in that sense. I think of things to ask about any process or situation that are much later than she does. She's up ahead of me. I don't think that's necessarily old age. I think that's always been so. I go along personally and accept a lot of what I think sounds reasonable, and that's been my attitude.
Well, I was going to ask then about your personal and family life and how that's affected your work and sources of personal satisfaction. And music's still part of it.
I've said a bit about my family already. My wife has given up her... Well, she didn't really have a scientific career. She started as a scientist. She had a job for a couple of years with CSIRO. But she gave it up because I was the one who had to move around. And this is always a problem with two people who are both want to have careers. They have to decide, can they have a family? Where are you going to go and work? Well, you've got to be able to get two jobs in the one city. My wife certainly chose to put the family first. She did later have a career part-time teaching in physics, but she put children first and put up with me being away when I was overseas attending to meetings and the late hours that I would occasionally keep, and she's been very supportive.
Well, personal satisfactions these days, music still...
Oh, yeah, well, that's good.
I mean, well, birding as well, I've discovered now.
Yes, we enjoy, my wife and I, going away on birding holidays. That's the best time between us. I was going to say that I get satisfaction from, you know, doing a piece of work properly, fully, and that's referred to by science anyway, that solving problems, that's the main interest, main activity I feel I've been on in very general terms. Whether the problems are major problems or global scale problems is not necessarily the case. I mean, right now I'm working on the problem of understanding the nature of our first zircon standard. For the shrimp iron microprobe, you've got to have a standard of known age that you determine in other ways. This is a problem, and I like to work on it, and I hope I'm going to solve it pretty soon.
You were made Fellow of the Royal Society in 1987.
Yeah.
That was...
And that was on the basis, I think, of the development of shrimp, as well as presumably previous contributions. I haven't read the citation that someone would have had to have made to support the case for election to the Royal Society. One of the guys who was pretty powerful in the British scene told me he felt like cheering when he heard the first talk I gave on the shrimp, which was in Hawaii at a meeting of the American Society of Mass Spectrometry.
Do you, in fact, have anything else you'd like to put on the record?
Well, I try to learn from my experience. I mean, I now advise graduate students not to marry before they finish their thesis, not to have children if they do get married, and to finish your thesis before leaving the university. I did all of those wrong things myself. So I'm trying to teach them not to do that.
Pretty successful life, though, all said.
notion of a cradle of humankind, a more politically correct replacement for the cradle of mankind, has a nice sort of appeal in the world of popular archaeology. It derives from Charles Darwin's prediction that Africa would prove to be the cradle, that place where our species was nurtured by Mother Nature. My own impression of Africa is that it is so fecund and has been for so long, it teems with life even today when the wildlife has been decimated. It is almost as though the chances were that it would throw up some amazing creature. But the cradle is a bit sentimental, given the reality that our remotest ancestors must have faced a physically very tough, often violent, disease-prone struggle to survive. But no doubt there were sweeter times and cradles even back in the trees where they might have learned a trick or two from the birds. The notion has an appeal that in places even attracts tourism. In my study, one can see that I am an unashamed enthusiast for these places. There are more than a few of them, especially in Africa. Ethiopia, Kenya, Tanzania, South Africa all have sites that claim the title, but also some in Asia, Indonesia and China, and India is looking for a breakthrough discovery. I've always found the study of human evolution very interesting. I don't know what percentage of the world's population know of this or accept it. Of course, there are many who reject it on religious grounds, but even secular critics have attacked Darwin. I think it is the great story to come from science. But not only is the story big, but so is the story of how it came to be written. It is also interesting how both stories manifest themselves in the popular culture. Every capital in Africa I saw has a museum with an account of the story. So do most science museums anywhere in the world. You can collect kitsch souvenirs from them. We'll be hearing a lot about Darwin in 2009, but the story of how the story has been unearthed is itself another long-running drama, coming slowly and somewhat painfully since the late 19th century. Look at the lives of Eugène Dubois, discoverer of Java Man, of the Leakey family in Africa, and other great contributors. There are some interesting books about it. I'll just mention, for example, The Discovery of the Hobbit by Mike Morwood and Penny van Osterzee, which includes an account of Dubois' life. Ancestral Passions by Virginia Morell is about the Leakeys. And Richard Leakey's own book, Origins Reconsidered, In Search of What Makes Us Human. Even though a properly objective scientific attitude or worldview does not allow us to think that humans have any special importance, nevertheless, the story that emerges from archaeology is still an enthralling drama. I find it hard to accept that it has all been some sort of fluke, a mere chance series of events. Even when we consider that the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs would have missed the Earth if it had arrived 20 minutes earlier or later. As anyone who has studied science and mathematics can affirm, it is always important to understand initial conditions. They are at least as important as the dynamics that follow on in any system. What were our initial conditions? Was it Arcadia or hell on Earth? We don't really know what they were. Life is of quite uncertain origin so far, and so is the moment when our ancestors went a different way to those of the chimps. But one of the first things we have to get our minds around here is the immense age of the Earth. I've looked at this before in other programs about geology things. For example, the writings of John McPhee, who coined the term deep time. As Bill Compton's work proves with scientific rigour, there's a good 4 billion years for life to evolve, and not just for the age of the Earth, but the Earth-Moon system too. Think of the tides coming and going twice a day, every day, for all the eons of time when so much of the evolution of life was taking place in the littoral between the high and low tide marks. The plants adapting to standing out of the water, the animals crawling out and learning to breathe the air. It's plenty of time for the thousands of generations to establish any species. I wouldn't be surprised if one day we can kick-start this process by beaming signals at complex minerals on distant planets, preparing them for settlement by humans who, as usual, arrive very late in the process. We all know the sort of analogies about how it happened on Earth. If the age of the Earth was the length of your arm, human history is like a single scrape of a nail file off your finger. If the age of the Earth is viewed as a single day, humans appear only in the last moments before midnight, and so on. It's strange how many people seem to be under the impression our ancestors knew dinosaurs. But time is not the only thing that is important. In fact, sheer duration is relatively less important than other things like morphology and behaviour. These things come, given enough time, and when they do, they move to centre stage. In my novel, The Expedition, the second part of the book is an attempt to dramatise the story of human evolution through the perceptions of a group of characters who, as it were, emerge in the course of the story in a series of steps. The first chapter of this section starts with a violent undersea birth and ends when two apes, mimicking the cranes on the open plains of Africa, stand up to dance in front of their gathered kin. This is a very long time span. It includes the move from water to land and the end of the dinosaurs. The next chapter ends with the first self-referential sentence being spoken. A character speaks her name. Both of these steps take place in the cradle. In the cradle we have the lullaby. Its gentle rhythms emulate the rise and fall of the wind and the swaying of the tree branches where mothers learnt to sing to an audience of one. Early speech followed the natural rise and fall of the breath. The first half-spoken words were crooned to babies, who then grew to talk. The next chapter of the book ends with the first sea voyage and so on. The time duration between each of these major steps is at least an order of magnitude less each time. I believe none of this was a fluke, because even from long before they got up to dance, they were trying it on these characters, our ancestors, and they kept doing that all the way through the many stages of our evolution, until the tribes came out of the deserts and founded cities. Then things changed, of course, but trying it on hasn't stopped. The expedition must always press forward. Please remember the Bill Compston interview is copyright to the National Library of Australia, and the extracts in this podcast are for personal use only. See the Bill Compston page on the study website regarding copyright, and for contact details for the library should you wish to access the full recording. Music in this podcast featured Michael Kieran Harvey playing his own composition, Pink Nautilus, from his album Rabid Bay. And my two regular themes, the Bach Prelude, played by Ronald Farren Price, and the Handel Suite, played by Elizabeth Anderson. All three are from Move Records, and full details are on the study website at www.thestudy.net.au. And so, until next time, it's shut the door and reading lamp only in the study.